Chapter 9. Business as Usual. With the U.S. military-industrial complex penetrated by unrepentant Nazis and their ideology, the globalists' attention to business and politics remained unabated. In the war's aftermath, some of the personalities who helped place Hitler in power came back into play. John J. McCloy, wartime Assistant Secretary of War, close friend to Deutsche Bank Chairman Dr. Hermann Josef Apps, and attorney for IG Farben, was appointed America's High Commissioner in Germany. As such, he pardoned more than 70,000 Nazis accused of war crimes. One example of McCloy's magnanimity came after 43 SS officers, including their leader, Obersturmbannführer Joachim Peiper, were condemned to death in 1946 for the massacre of more than 100 American prisoners near Malmedy, Belgium, during the Battle of the Bulge. As historian William L. Shirer wrote in The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, in March 1948, 39 of the death sentences were commuted. In April, General Lucius D. Clay reduced the death sentences from 121 to 6. And in January 1951, under a general amnesty, John J. McCloy, the American High Commissioner, commuted all the remaining death sentences to life imprisonment. At the time of writing, 1959, all have been released. Once again, hidden from public scrutiny, high U.S. officials had moved to free convicted Nazis. According to former U.S. Attorney John Loftus, about 300 ranking Nazi sympathizers from the Belarus region of the Soviet Union were brought to the United States after the war in hopes they could provide intelligence on the motives and abilities of the Soviets. In tracking the activities of such collaborators, Loftus uncovered a secret unit within the State Department called the Office of Policy Coordination, OPC, which he said was hidden away from normal government operations and answerable only to Secretary of Defense James V. Forrestal and the Dulles faction in the State Department. Loftus found that the OPC had recruited Nazi collaborators to fight against communism. When it was discovered that their work was ineffectual, these Nazis were allowed to immigrate to the United States, their former activities concealed. Such men included former Belarusian President Radoslav Ostrovsky, who was offered immunity from prosecution for war crimes, Franz Kuschel, an SS general who commanded the Belarus Brigade and was responsible for the execution of more than 40,000 Jews, Stanislav Stankovich, who organized the execution of 7,000 Jews, and Emanuel Yasiuk, who, as the wartime mayor of Kletsk, supervised the execution of more than 5,000 Jews in just one day. Both Ostrovsky and Yasiuk are buried in a South River, New Jersey cemetery near a monument to Belarusian war veterans, which is topped by the image of an Iron Cross. In 1948, soon-to-be CIA Director Alan Dulles, who had been on hand in 1921 for the creation of the Council on Foreign Relations, authorized Frank Wisner to use false paperwork to maintain the Vatican rat lines for escaping Nazis. Within a year, Wisner's Nazis were working for CIA propaganda fronts such as Radio Liberty and the Voice of America. Dulles had encouraged the choice of Wisner as head of the OPC, which undertook active operations against the Soviet Union as the Cold War developed. Although OPC agents in Europe wore U.S. military uniforms, they were paid by the CIA. According to Loftus, OPC's program emanated almost entirely from the State Department's policy and planning staff, headed by George Kennan. Every U.S. government administration since the CFR's inception has been packed with council members. Conservative journalist and CFR researcher James Perloff noted that through 1988, 14 secretaries of state, 14 secretaries of treasury, 11 secretaries of defense, and scores of other federal department heads were members of the CFR. This trend continued through both the Bill Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. Current and former members of the CFR in the 2000 Bush cabinet included Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Elaine Chao, Robert M. Gates, Joshua B. Bolton, and Susan Schwab. The like-mindedness of CFR members, one cannot ask to join, you must be invited and pass a stringent vetting process to show that you are in agreement with their worldview, along with their close ties with the corporate business world, has caused many conspiracy writers to view the CFR as a group with plans to control the world through multinational business mergers, economic treaties, and global government. The activities of the CFR may have been summarized by sociologist G. William Domhoff, who wrote, "If conspiracy means that these men are aware of their interests, know each other personally, meet together privately and off the record, and try to hammer out a consensus on how to anticipate and react to events and issues, then there is some conspiring that goes on in CFR, not to mention the Committee for Economic Development, the Business Council, the National Security Council, and the Central Intelligence Agency. Many of the Council's members have a personal financial interest in foreign relations, because it is their property and investments that are guarded by the State Department and the military," noted researcher Laurie Strand in the 1981 edition of The People's Almanac, No. 3. Nothing had changed since the 1960s, when President John F. Kennedy's special advisor, John Kenneth Galbraith, bemoaned, "Those of us who had worked for the Kennedy election were tolerated in the government for that reason and had a say, but foreign policy was still with the Council on Foreign Relations." Even today's terrorist groups may be traced back to the Nazis, which prompts speculation on who is truly behind them. According to Peter Lavenda's Unholy Alliance, Otto Skorzeny, the Nazi commando who may have found Solomon's treasure, made his way to post-war Egypt, where he created an Egyptian Gestapo staffed almost completely with former SS officers. According to Lavenda, this was a measure that received wholehearted support from CIA Director Alan Dulles, who was at that time involved with Richard Galen in developing an anti-communist espionage service within the ranks of CIA. This operation encompassed the Nazi-associated Muslim Brotherhood, a progenitor of today's Al-Qaeda terrorist organization. The connection between Muslim fanatics and Nazis, according to John Loftus, began with Muslim Brotherhood founder Hassan el-Banna, who formed a group of Egyptian youth dedicated to social reform and Islamic morals. He was a devotee of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, the 18th century Muslim who founded the Wahhabi sect that teaches that any additions or interpretations of Islam after the 10th century are false and should be eradicated, even by violence. In the 1920s, there was a young Egyptian named Albana, and Albana formed this nationalist group called the Muslim Brotherhood. Albana was a devout admirer of Adolf Hitler and wrote to him frequently. So persistent was he in his admiration of the new Nazi party that in the 1930s, Albana and the Muslim Brotherhood became a secret arm of Nazi intelligence, said Loftus, who had unprecedented access to secret U.S. government and NATO intelligence files. The Arab Nazis had much in common with the new Nazi doctrines. They hated Jews. They hated democracy. And they hated the Western culture. It became the official policy of the Third Reich to secretly develop the Muslim Brotherhood as the Fifth Parliament, an army inside Egypt. When war broke out, the Muslim Brotherhood promised in writing that they would rise up and help General Rommel and make sure that no English or American soldier was left alive in Cairo or Alexandria. While they obviously failed in this, it is a fact that Arab raiders caused continual problems for Allied forces. After World War II, the Muslim Brotherhood and its German intelligence handlers were sought for war crimes, as they were not considered regular military units. Following arrests in Cairo, captured Brotherhood members were turned over to the British Secret Service, who hired them to fight against the infant state of Israel in 1948. Loftus stated, Only a few people in the Mossad know this, but many of the members of the Arab armies and terrorist groups that tried to strangle the infant state of Israel were the Arab Nazis of the Muslim Brotherhood. What the British did then, they sold the Arab Nazis to the predecessor, the OSS, of what became the CIA, soon to be headed by Alan Dulles. It may sound stupid, it may sound evil, but it did happen. The idea was that we were going to use the Arab Nazis in the Middle East as a counterweight to the Arab communists. Just as the Soviet Union was funding Arab communists, we would fund the Arab Nazis to fight against them. And lots of secret classes took place. We kept the Muslim Brotherhood on our payroll. But the Egyptians became nervous. Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser ordered all of the Muslim Brotherhood to get out of Egypt in 1954 or be imprisoned and we would execute them all. During the 1950s, the CIA evacuated the Nazis of the Muslim Brotherhood to Saudi Arabia, still a stronghold of the Wahhabi sect. Now, when they arrived in Saudi Arabia, one student was named Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden was taught by the Nazis of the Muslim Brotherhood, who had emigrated to Saudi Arabia. In 1979, the CIA drew fanatics from these Saudi Brotherhood members and sent them to Afghanistan to fight the Soviet Russians. "We had to rename them," said Loftus. "We couldn't call them the Muslim Brotherhood because that was too sensitive a name. Its Nazi caste was too known. So we called them the Maktab al-Qadimat al-Mujahideen, the MAK. We left this army of Arab fascists in the field of Afghanistan. Once out of Afghanistan, the Mujahideen became known as Al-Qaeda, or the base. While some people still think the term base refers to some central headquarters, former British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook told the House of Commons the term actually referred to a computer database containing the names of Muslim activists, Mujahideen, and others long used by the CIA. Following the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Saudis didn't want the fanatics to return, so they bribed Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda followers to stay out of Saudi Arabia. There are many flavors and branches, but they are all Muslim Brotherhoods. So the Muslim Brotherhood became this poison that spread throughout the Middle East, and on 9/11, it began to spread around the world, concluded Loftus, who added that current CIA members don't know this story. The current generation CIA are good and decent Americans, and I like them a lot. They're trying to do a good job, but part of their problem is their files have been shredded. All of these secrets have to come out. During the 1950s, while Dulles headed the CIA, his brother, John Foster Dulles, was President Eisenhower's Secretary of State. Both were in prime positions to shape the Nazification of America. In the chill of the Cold War, few Americans remembered that John Foster Dulles had been pro-Nazi before Hitler invaded Poland, observed Walter Bauert, a journalist and former editor who authored the book Operation Mind Control. No one thought, either, to question the fact that while John Foster Dulles was running the State Department, his brother Alan was running the CIA, which he once described as a State Department for dealing with unfriendly governments. No one seemed at all disturbed by the Dulles dynasty, and only a handful of people realized to what extent the Dulles brothers held power in the Eisenhower administration. The German banking industry particularly profited from such connections as the Dulles brothers and McCloy. Immediately after the war ended, Allied authorities ordered the breakup of Germany's largest bank, Deutsche Bank. Initially, the banking giant was split into 10 regional banks, but by 1953, these were consolidated into three major banks, Norddeutsche Bank AG, Süddeutsche Bank AG, and Rheinisch-Westfälische Bank AG. A mere 4 years later, without any opposition, these three major banks merged and began takeovers, including the London Morgan Grenfell Investment Bank in 1989, the East German Central Bank following reunification in 1990, Bankers Trust of New York in 1999, and two large Russian banks in 2006. By the turn of the current century, Deutsche Bank was reunited and had become a world banking leader. Astute authorities in both Britain and the United States undoubtedly recognized Deputy Führer Martin Bormann's flight capital plan. But they were dissuaded from action by the general euphoria at the war's end, the chaotic conditions in Europe, the idea that growth would restore the wrecked European economy, and the increasing belief that the United States would soon have to confront a victorious and powerful Soviet Union. There was also the behind-the-scenes power of men in banking and commerce who had been in league with the Nazis and still carried sympathy for their cause. Treasury officials in Washington, as in London, knew what was transpiring. The teams they sent into the field uncovered enough evidence to prove a definite pattern, wrote Paul Manning. As for the news media, it did not seem important, although long-term, it was really the biggest of the post-war stories. Yet so quietly was it handled by the Germans, and so diffident was the reaction by the Allies, that few ripples rose to the surface, and investigators of the U.S. Treasury Department were taken off the case. Investigators were reassigned by their superiors, some of whom had been business partners with the Nazis for years. One such example was attorney Russell A. Nixon, who, as a member of the U.S. military government cartel unit, found himself working directly under Brigadier General William H. Draper, Jr., an advocate of eugenics, who sat with James Forrestal on the board of directors of Dillon Reed Company, the firm that early on had helped finance the German cartels. According to Professor Anthony C. Sutton, three Wall Street houses, Dillon Reed, Harris Forbes, and National Cities Bank, handled three-quarters of the reparation loans used to create the German cartel system, including the dominant IG Farben and Vereinigte Stahlwerke, which together produced 95% of the explosives for the Nazis' side in World War II. Nixon was blocked at every turn in his attempt to break up the Farben cartel. He finally went over the head of Brigadier General Draper, meeting with General Lucius D. Clay, military governor of the U.S. zone in Germany. The general was told Draper had canceled orders to dismantle or destroy Farben facilities, lied about bomb damage to Farben plants, and deliberately violated General Eisenhower's orders to break up the Farben cartel. Despite Nixon's complaints, nothing was done. When Nixon took the initiative and had Nazi industrialist Richard Freudenberg arrested, U.S. Ambassador to Germany Robert Murphy ordered him released. One occupation official explained Murphy's decision by commenting, "This man Freudenberg is an extremely capable industrialist, a kind of Henry Ford." Nixon later told a Senate subcommittee in Washington, "Generally speaking, in spite of the efforts that have been made, at the present time there is a continuation of the dissipation and further concealment of these Nazi assets throughout all the neutral countries." Another Allied investigator, Department of Justice attorney James Stewart Martin, was sent to U.S. military command in London to investigate collaboration between the Nazis and American businessmen. Martin bristled when he found his commanding officer was a Colonel Graham K. Howard, an official with General Motors. After Martin pointed out the cozy relationship General Motors had with the Nazis, Howard was quietly reassigned back to the States. Martin later investigated the fate of ITT's German chairman, Gerhard Westrich, who, after the war ended, had fled Berlin and hidden out in a castle in southern Germany. After presenting a report on the status of ITT firms to U.S. military authorities, Westrich was given a light prison sentence and released. Martin found that queries concerning General Annalein and Film's connections to IG Farben had been referred to Alan Dulles with no results. "We had not been stopped in Germany by German business. We had been stopped in Germany by American business," Martin wrote in the 1950 book All Honorable Men. "The forces that stopped us had operated from the United States, but had not operated in the open. Whatever it was that had stopped us was not the government, but it clearly had command of channels through which the government normally operates. The relative powerlessness of governments in the growing economic power is, of course, not new. National governments have stood on the sidelines while bigger operators arranged the world's affairs. One of those insiders who helped protect Nazi interests in the wake of World War II was aforementioned William H. Draper, Jr., a business partner with Prescott Bush, who, in July 1945, was appointed head of the Economic Division of the U.S. Control Commission, which decided which Nazi corporations would be saved and who would face war crimes prosecutions. This placed Draper in almost as powerful a position as Germany's new High Commissioner, John J. McCloy, who, besides banking for the Nazis, had spent a year in Italy as a financial advisor to Mussolini and shared Hitler's box at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. Martin also may have stumbled across the answer to why the international business community turned against Hitler. The leading bankers and industrialists were looking forward to a post-war world composed of intertwining corporate business connections among the nations of the world. A new world order. Hitler, on the other hand, was planning to attack the United States just as soon as he had effective rocket and long-range bomber delivery systems in place. The globalists did not desire a continuous war, nor did they want Hitler to control a world national socialist government. They had their own plans. The 750 new corporations established under the Bormann Flight Capital Program gave themselves absolute control over a post-war economic network of viable, prosperous companies that stretched from the Ruhr to the neutrals of Europe and to the countries of South America. A control that continues today and is easily maintained through the bearer bonds or shares issued by these corporations to cloak real ownership, stated Paul Manning, who worked with Edward R. Murrow covering the war in Europe for CBS Radio. Manning revealed that there are U.S. Treasury old-timers of World War II still not aware of the magnitude of the Bormann operation and of its success. Those who know, in Washington, in South America, and in the capitals of Europe, are locked together in a conspiracy of silence. No one in a position of power within the financial centers of Washington, Wall Street, the City of London, or Paris desired a real search for the scattered German assets. Manning explained, they had understandable reasons, if you overlook morality. The financial benefits for collaboration had become an old hat term with the war winding down, were very enticing, depending on one's importance and ability to be of service to the organization and the 750 corporations they were secretly manipulating, to say nothing of the known multinationals such as IG Farben, Tyson AG, and Siemens. Without the German industrial base that had been its foundation for years, the European economy was suffering. U.S. Joint Chief of Staff directives had ordered that nothing be done to rebuild Germany's industries. But business is business, and by the summer of 1947, President Roosevelt's friend and Chief of Staff, General George Catlett Marshall, had become Secretary of State under President Truman. The son of a prosperous coal producer and a participant in every high-level policy conference from Casablanca to Yalta and Potsdam, Marshall convinced Truman that it was in the best interests of European prosperity that Germany be allowed to rehabilitate its economy. Thus, the Marshall Plan was born, and millions of dollars of aid began pouring into war-devastated Europe. Many Americans, including Colonel Robert McCormick, editor of the Chicago Tribune, and Senator Joseph McCarthy, attacked the Marshall Plan as merely another Rockefeller scheme to bilk American taxpayers. According to Mullins, the Marshall Plan had been rushed through Congress by a powerful and vocal group, headed by Winthrop Aldrich, president of Chase Manhattan Bank, and Nelson Rockefeller's brother-in-law, ably seconded by Nelson Rockefeller and William Clayton, the head of Anderson Clayton Company. Marshall Plan money flowed through the same banking conduits as before the war, such as the 1936 partnership between the J. Henry Schroeder Bank of New York and Rockefeller family members, described by Time magazine as the economic booster of the Rome-Berlin axis. Partners in Schroeder, Rockefeller & Company included Avery Rockefeller, nephew of John D., Baron Bruno von Schroeder in London, and Kurt Freiherr von Schroeder of the Bank of International Settlements and the Gestapo in Cologne. Attorneys for the firm were John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles of Sullivan & Cromwell. Future CIA director and Warren Commission member Alan Dulles sat on the board of Schroeder. Further connections linked the Paris branch of Chase National Bank to Schroeder, as well as the pro-Nazi Worms Bank and Standard Oil of New Jersey in France. Standard Oil's Paris representatives were directors of the Banque de Paris et des Pays-Bas, which had intricate connections to the Nazis and to Chase, noted New York Times journalist Charles Higham. William Branly, who researched the causes of war in his 1990 book, The Gods of Eden, noted these international banking connections. Max Warburg, a major German banker, and his brother Paul Warburg, who had been instrumental in establishing the Federal Reserve System in the United States, were directors of IG Farben. H. A. Metz of IG Farben was a director of the Warburg Bank of Manhattan, which later became part of the Rockefeller Chase Manhattan Bank. Standard Oil of New Jersey had been a cartel partner with IG Farben prior to the war. One American IG Farben director was C. E. Mitchell, who was also director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and of Warburg's National City Bank. It is interesting to note that throughout the war, Chase maintained its financial connections with the Nazis through its Paris bank. Further, IG Farben chief Hermann Schmitz served as Chase president for 7 years prior to the war. According to Manning, Schmitz's wealth, largely IB Farben bearer bonds, converted to the big three successor firms, shares in Standard Oil of New Jersey, equal to those held by the Rockefellers, General Motors, and other U.S. blue-chip industrial stocks, and the 700 secret companies controlled in his time by IG Farben, as well as shares in the 750 corporations he helped Bormann establish during the last years of World War II, has increased in all segments of the modern industrial world. The Bormann Organization in South America utilizes the voting power of the Schmitz Trust along with their own assets to guide the multinationals they control as they keep steady the economic course of the fatherland. After the war, 24 lower IG Farben executives stood trial at Nuremberg for crimes against humanity, including the building and maintenance of concentration camps and the use of slave labor. Schmitz was convicted of war crimes in 1948 at Nuremberg, but served a mere 2 years in prison, although it was under Schmitz's leadership that the giant chemical combine produced and distributed the notorious Cyclone B gas, used for human extermination in Nazi concentration camps. Regarding the relationship between Schmitz and Martin Bormann, Manning wrote, "Their association was close and trusting over the years, and it is the considered opinion of those in their circle that the wealth possessed by Hermann Schmitz was shifted to Switzerland and South America and placed in trust with Bormann, the legal heir to Hitler." These long-standing banking and business connections, coupled with the Schmitz business network, allowed Reichsleiter Martin Bormann to forge a formidable Nazi-controlled organization for post-war activities. The late Jim Keith, author of several conspiracy books, wrote, "In researching the shape of totalitarian control during this century, I saw that the plans of the Nazis manifestly did not die with the German loss of World War II. The ideology and many of the principal players survived and flourished after the war and have had a profound impact on post-war history and on events taking place today." Interestingly enough, the Nazis' attempt at central control through the economic sector produced the early stages of a united Europe so sought by Hitler. After the war, a devastated Europe looked to Germany for economic leadership. The economic steps taken that became the common market took the shape of pre-war Nazi plans. Somehow, the Germans had the answer originally in 1942, when they were melding the economic institutions of the continent into their own design, noted Manning. It is interesting to note that the present European Union, EU, began as merely economic measures. From this reasonable beginning as a trade organization, the common market evolved into the European Union, a supranational and intergovernmental body with tendrils into all aspects of European life. In 1950, French Foreign Minister Robert Schuman proposed the joint management of the French and West German coal and steel industries. This Schuman Declaration, ratified by the 1951 Treaty of Paris, was the first step toward what Winston Churchill termed a United States of Europe. The 1951 treaty between Belgium, France, Italy, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and West Germany provided for the shared production of coal and steel. It was thought that this mutual endeavor would ensure against another war between these nations. It also could be seen as a means of consolidating the Nazi business holdings of the Bormann Organization. The European Economic Community, better known as the Common Market, was established in 1957 by the Treaty of Rome, signed by the same nations as in 1951. George McGee, a member of the secretive Bilderberg Group and former U.S. ambassador to West Germany, acknowledged that the Treaty of Rome, which brought the common market into being, was nurtured at Bilderberg meetings. Again, the common market was styled as merely a step toward equalizing trade balances and tariffs. But with the 1992 signing of the treaty establishing the European Community, popularly known as the Maastricht Treaty, the word economic was deleted from both the treaty and the community. By 2000, the European Union was composed of various economic, political, and judicial institutions, including the European Central Bank, the European Parliament, the European Court of Justice, and a unified European currency, the euro. The 1942 Nazi vision of a unified Europe had become a reality. But if the reality of the Nazi vision of a unified Europe appeared to signal success for the emerging Fourth Reich, nothing showed more success than the seeds that had been sowed in the post-war United States. In the post-war period, FDR Democrats who looked favorably on federal, social, and economic controls were firmly in the pocket of the global corporate elite, although there was a small problem with President Harry S. Truman, who was never fully under their command. So, Truman, like Jimmy Carter, was elected to only one term. The real problem lay with the Republicans, longtime supporters of less government and more economic freedom. One willing accomplice of the globalist Nazi nexus was an obscure Republican politician from California. According to authors John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, when Truman was re-elected in 1948, future President Richard M. Nixon became Alan Dulles's mouthpiece in Congress. Both he and Senator Joseph McCarthy received volumes of classified information to support the charge that the Truman administration was filled with pinkos. When McCarthy went too far in his communist investigations, it was Nixon who worked with his next-door neighbor, CIA Director Walter Bedell Smith, to steer the investigations away from the intelligence community and the Nazis. The partnership between Alan Dulles and Richard Nixon was truly a Faustian bargain, but it is hard to tell just who is Faust and who is Mephistopheles in the scenario, wrote Peter Lavenda. Nixon, who joined the Council on Foreign Relations in 1961, but resigned in 1965 after his membership became a campaign issue, got an initial boost to his political career by befriending a Nazi named Nicolae Malaxa. A Romanian who was a former business partner of Nazi Luftwaffe chief Hermann Göring, Malaxa had belonged to Baron Otto von Bolschwing's Gestapo network, as had his associate Valerian Trifa, who was then living in Detroit. Both were members of the Nazi Iron Guard in Romania and had fled prosecution for their role in the deaths of many Jews. Their common interest was in Richard Nixon, who was elected vice president in 1952. In late 1946, Nixon's influence, along with that of the Dulles brothers, freed Malaxa's money frozen in Chase National Bank during the war. The Treasury Department official whose firm won Malaxa's case to release the money was the same man who froze these assets in the first place. Such interrelationships were very common between émigré fascists and the right wing of the American establishment, noted Loftus and Ahrens. According to the late May Brussel, a California conspiracy researcher and hostess of the World Watchers International radio program, Trefa came to the United States with the help of the opportunistic Baron von Bolschfing, an early member of the Nazi Party and highly placed intelligence operative. Malaxa had escaped from Europe with more than $200 million in U.S. dollars. In America, following the retrieval of his frozen assets, Malaxa gained another $200 million from Chase Manhattan Bank. The legalities were handled by the Dulles Brothers law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. Undersecretary of State Adolph Burl, who had helped Nixon and star witness Whitaker Chambers convict Alger Hiss, personally testified on Malaxa's behalf before a congressional subcommittee on immigration, noted Brussel. A company called Western Tube was another effort to further help Malaxa. In 1951, Nixon introduced a private bill in Congress which would have allowed Malaxa to remain in the United States despite provisions of the Displaced Persons Act, which prohibited persons with fascist backgrounds. When this effort failed, Malaxa pretended to create Western Tube, which manufactured a seamless tube that he claimed was vital to the Korean War effort. Loftus and Ahrens reported, "He set up his company in Nixon's hometown of Whittier, California, and registered it in the same building as the law firm of Bewley, Krupp, and Nixon. Nixon's former law partner, Thomas Bewley, was secretary of Malaxa's company, and the vice president was another Nixon crony. They added that Western Tube never made any tubes. The company was used to evade millions of dollars worth of taxes and then dissolved," they noted. It was the $2 million fee Nixon received from Malaxa that funded his successful election campaign for Congress. In 1946, Nixon had gotten a call from Herman L. Perry asking if he wanted to run for Congress against Representative Jerry Voorhis. Perry later became president of Western Tube, wrote May Brussel. In 1952, in spite of being granted permanent resident status in the United States, Malaxa moved from Whittier to Argentina, where he joined Argentine dictator Juan Perón and Hitler's chief commando Otto Skorzeny in profitable business dealings with the network created by Martin Bormann and Alan Dulles. Meanwhile, ranking Republicans were abetting the influx of Nazis. Elmer Holmes Bobst of Warner Lambert Pharmaceutical, described as a mentor and father figure to Nixon, was a power behind Nixon's 1960 presidential campaign. Bobst was a close associate of Otto von Bolschfing, head of the Gestapo network that included Malaxa and Trefa. In preparation for the 1952 Eisenhower-Nixon campaign, the Republicans formed an ethnic division which, to put it bluntly, recruited the displaced fascists who arrived in the United States after World War II, wrote Loftus and Ahrens. To mask the wave of Nazis flooding into the United States and to gain tighter federal control over Americans, the pre-war specter of the communist menace was resurrected. A quick look at America's reaction to liberation movements in post-war Europe demonstrates the hypocrisy of the often stated Eisenhower-era Republican policies to roll back communism. In 1953, 500,000 citizens of the so-called German Democratic Republic, GDR, staged a revolt against the East German regime, only to be violently suppressed by its troops and tanks. No further large-scale demonstrations were to take place in East Germany until 1989, the year before the GDR ceased to exist. 3 years later, Polish workers attempted their own rebellion against the communist regime. Widespread violence was only averted after China's Mao Zedong convinced Russian Premier Nikita Khrushchev to allow Polish communist Władysław Gomułka to assume authority and institute reforms in Poland. In late October 1956, the people of Hungary spontaneously rose up against their Soviet occupiers, many in response to broadcasts of support by the BBC, Radio Free Europe, and the Voice of America. Put off guard by initial offers of compromise by the Russians, the Hungarians were unprepared for the full-scale military assault on Budapest on November 4th. Thousands were killed, and an estimated 200,000 fled the country. This Soviet show of force maintained their control over Central Europe and also perpetuated the idea that communism was monolithic and irresistible. In discussing three books on the failed Hungarian Revolution, 12 Days by Victor Sebestyen, Failed Illusions by Charles Gatti, and Journey to a Revolution by Michael Korda, New York Times book reviewer Jacob Heilbrun noted, despite promiscuous pledges to roll back communism, President Dwight Eisenhower and Secretary of State John Foster Dulles had no intention of rolling back anything. In a National Security Council meeting, Vice President Richard Nixon even stated that a Soviet invasion would not be an unmixed evil for the West, as it would bolster the alliance against communism.